We'll go ahead and get started. Regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. Supplemental meeting will be recessed. We can start off with a moment of silence for those who are not with us anymore. Thank you. Next, we'll go to the minutes from the meeting of May 9th. Do we have both the required public and the regular meeting, Josh? Do we have two, or are they sort of combined as one?
I think you have indeed one motion for both.
Okay. Okay. Any comments? If not, can I have a make a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, public comment.
We have a live star on your phone. I'll unmute the phone. Okay.
All right, nothing. Okay, now we're going to go to item C1, where, we're going to talk about the 2.025. I guess one thing I'd like to say, beforehand is that I've been working, mainly with Kelly and Josh on this issue and discussions with the city. And, I think what we really want to accomplish today is both a further update and education, but we really need kind of a sense of the will of the board as it primarily relates to the difference between what we are advocating for and what I would call our bare bones responsibility pursuant to our roles as trustee and the requirements of the legislation. So there's a difference, one builds upon the other, but there's a difference between the two, and we want to make that clear and obvious to everyone and get a sense. And really, it comes down to how much do we believe in and want to take a stand relative to a COLA adjustment for people that either going forward or in the past have not had one. And we've expressed so far in our discussions with the city a strong level of desire to have that. But it's our collective group that will ultimately decide what we want to do. So we want to educate, discuss, and at least get a sense of it. And that's kind of how I want to tee things up for Kelly.
All right, good morning, everybody. So as Nick said, we're going to have the conversation again today that we've had before, and I really want to talk or get your feelings about the COLA. It's going to be the biggest part of the conversation. We don't have a lot of new information to present to you, not a new recommendation or anything, but have some other comparisons for you to think about. But before I do that, I wanted to start with the other meeting that happened at the Pension Committee's meeting this week, which was an investment presentation that the city commissioned the work to be done. And I know we sent you an article from, is the California News?
There's the California News and the KERA.
Right. We sent you those and I think the presentation. So I'm going to ask Ryan to just talk briefly about that and tell you what we're expecting next from that.
Okay, so the meeting was last Thursday. We got a copy of the report kind of midweek. And from our standpoint, there are several issues with the report that the agency sent at our committee. A few of the key ones, they did not reach out to us until the day before the presentation to learn about the investment portfolio at all. There were several apples and oranges comparisons with historic investment results where they were comparing our year end 12/31/22 to year end plan 6/30/22 with what happened in 22 with how volatile the market was, vastly skewed the results. We got some of that corrected, but they did not correct everything in the report. So we have a meeting tomorrow at the city with Commerce Street to go through what the plan is going forward from the phase two of their sitting down and talking is we're willing to work with them on the fall report, provide information, meet with them, hopefully get up to speed on the portfolio, what our governance policy procedures are, but with the expectation that they will come to the board of the ISD to present their findings so we have a chance to respond to that report.
So do we have the option not to, work with them?
I think we do. I think that would be viewed poorly on our behalf. But sure.
I spoke to Dory Wiley yesterday. He reached out to me, and he told me that he was told not to contact us prior to that day or so before the report. That was a surprise by Jack Ireland. And so that was a surprising fact. He was very conciliatory in his words, and what I asked him to do as, you know, an agenda item for tomorrow was that working from Ryan's work product, that they would work to agree on one database of numbers. What are the actual historical returns? What are the peer group comparisons and indexes? And that if we can get out of that meeting where he basically concurs with Ryan's work product, then to me, at least that's a better for ongoing discussion. So you're not debating whether something is an 8 or a 9 or whatever. You know, you're working from the same set of numbers, then you can have a good discussion on interpreting those. And, you know, there's always going to be some suggestions that make sense. You know, him pointing out, you know, that U.S. stock markets have done better than global stock markets in the last 10, 12 years. So if you were more weighted that way, you would have done a little better. Yeah, it's a good point. That, you know, it's true. And, you know, that's just kind of how things work. You know, we believe in proper diversification and allocation and those sorts of things. So there's going to be a couple of things he points out. What he pointed out about private equity makes no sense because we didn't have the cash to do it and we were working out of a troubled PE portfolio already. So, you know, but we want to work from the same database, and then to me that's at least a better place to try to find common ground.
I just wonder in terms of the real purpose is to view oversight improvement or whether there's an issue there. And I just don't think that's appropriate at this time. I mean, I think with what everything's going on in terms of trying to get a resolution, that's certainly a part of it. But I think it's a distraction.
I agree with you totally. My belief is the catalyst are two city council members who are on the ad hoc committee who were very forceful and outspoken about this. And so that's my observation, that they're the ones that sort of required or mandated this. I think it would be bad faith not to cooperate, even though we don't really see the purpose, and I agree it could be a distraction.
Let me just say one thing, is that I had a conversation with one of the council members about this bringing on an investment consultant. And I wasn't necessarily opposed to it, but there were caveats to that. That the growth of the entity would be qualified, impartial, and would not impede the progress in negotiations thus far. And that is not what is happening. This entity is neither qualified, impartial, and indefinitely. I have been on the investment committee twice, vetting investment consultants. I've never heard of this organization.
Can I answer that?
Yes.
So there's just two things. So I was asked, you know, what he mentions, or I watched the video, and I think that they had mentioned that they had hired or looked at four proposals or something, and ultimately picked them. I mean, there's a litany of professional pension consultants that you could pick, and they chose him, which is really curious to me. And what I would say is that firm is in the industry that I work in every single day. Like, I've known them for 20-plus years, and there is all kinds of weird, strange, bizarre things around how they do business, and they are not viewed very highly in the core industry that they work in. So,
which is banking.
Which is community banking.
Right.
They advise, well, it's interesting because they kind of do a little bit, a lot of things now as they've evolved. their core business is advisory for community banks, and they do not have a great reputation doing that.
So my thinking is this. I mean, we saw the result of the report that was developed when they didn't talk to us, right? And there's going to be another report. And I don't want another naive people to call us report out there because they didn't bother to ask. So what I'd like to do is to be able to give them the opportunity to get the best information. And if they choose to use that because they're really trying to do a good product, then that's great. I mean, we can't do anything about the fact that they're trying to just make us look bad. But that's one of the reasons we want them to then, for our cooperation, be willing to come and talk to the board or the IAC, because then they get the opportunity to present to you all. And they're going to know, you all know what's going on with this portfolio. Our portfolio is difficult to understand just by looking at what's on the website on how we got here, why we're doing what we're doing, what our restraints are, and I think we'll have a better product if we do cooperate with them. But there's nothing that they...
As long as they get up to speed, I'm sure, you know, we're a liability-driven investment.
Right.
That is not what everything is. I mean, you have to get them up to speed in order for them to do that, right?
Right.
My other issue, which is a bigger issue, is that this entity, Mr. Wiley, has now politicized his position and what he's doing. I have never seen Makita, Cambridge, Wilshire, none of them mentioned and consulted me with fire and police leadership before they meet with staff. From what I understand, when you're impartial, you just go to the data. You just look at the data.
Yeah.
But to put your position in front of our membership base and say, you know what, let's go to the data out some more. That is politicizing that position. I've never seen an investment consultant go to our membership like that before they even go to the investment staff. That is just incredibly marginally unethical.
I'm just not sure the risk is worth the political whatever thing, you know, could be the result if we cooperate. I'm not sure.
I don't know if we can get a good result if we cooperate or if we don't.
One thought occurs to me in discussion, I think it's a good suggestion. This is politics, it's just not good about it. This is politics. That in the past, we're caught in the middle of politics over on Morello Street. It's unfortunate, but it is the way it is. I think that there's a lot of facts out there relating that some of you all brought up. Other facts are out there. And, you know, the phrase, you know, sunshine's the best disinfectant, I think he'll do his report, you know, with whatever input he takes from us. You all have an opportunity to comment on the report. You also have an opportunity to bring up facts and other facts relating to him and his business and what you said, Tony, and other facts, you know. And then people can judge what, you know, the value or the lack of value of what he produces. I think that that's the fairest way, it seems to me, to go about the process, recognizing that we are caught in an inherently political and in some ways unfair political process and fight. So, you know, it seems like that is the more prudent way to approach the situation.
Could we not say, we don't have a problem with the analysis report,
yes,
but we don't think this one is qualified and we select the view of time?
No, how about they go to the PRB and go to their list? I assure you, what let me give the Skyrock? I get that you can't use Makita. I get that you can't use Skyrock. First of all, I thought they had the lawyer, which they called the consultant anyway, which I think they could have effectively used. But let's say you wanted an independent. Go to the PRB.
Well, then the city can hire who they choose to hire.
Even if they're incompetent.
Sure.
Most of the time they do.
Kevin, my blog started off where you were, like, to what end? I mean, that's kind of the where I started. But I think we just have to think downrange that, you know, we're in front of the state legislature. They make a comment that we didn't cooperate with their, I mean, you know, the goal is that's a resolution for our, you know, our membership. My gut tells me, you know, to cooperate, I don't see any further downside to it for us from where we sit. There's some chance, you know, for upside. And all, I know Dory, I know Palmer Street, you know, pretty well over the last 15, 20 years. guess, and this is pure speculation, is there's no one else that could do it. No one else is willing to do it in the time frame for the money that they were willing to do it. And
you get what you pay for.
Yeah. That's the way I read it. And, you know, he does sit on, is it UTIMCO, or is it on one of the other? He sits on one of them.
He was on TRS, but that wasn't, he's been off the.
So we're going to come to the conclusion that that's what they can come up with, right? But I refuse to sit there and say they never have closed when they don't, okay? And I want to point the audience, which is he's not qualified. So any kind of conclusion he's going to come up with, is going to come up with, he's already come up with conclusions and he hasn't really vetted his data effectively.
Yeah, he has, you know, the Dennis Pancake has two sides to it. His view, or his thing to me, is that what he told me was that he was told not to talk to us, and that in his view, that report was not to be made public and it was just a draft. So he has a view that's different from our perception of what reality is, and he was beyond conciliatory in his discussion with me.
And I went to the meeting. When he puts up a book up, and there were a lot of members, both from ERF and from me, they were both there. I was there. And I have never seen investment consultant ever put up Texas pensions where we were dead last, second to last. It is, you have to go to the public and are outright, not that we're trying to hide something or that we're doing anything bad, but it explains why I'm strategy. Because it has to be similar to similar. And my point, I rock my brain to come up with a very understandable analogy instead of apples to oranges. You know what that shows? It shows there are two entities there. There are drivers, IT investment staff, and there are vehicles, okay? And so you have a Porsche at the top, and let's talk about a Vespa, okay? And then you have drivers, and they're in this race. What he said, which is dangerous, okay? Which is two things, if the conclusion is. You can have a subpar driver with a great Porsche and go very far. You can have a heck of a driver to use the Best Buy and still be in the race, okay? And that's my issue, because any investment consultant would have put that up, which is so irresponsible, would have had two pages of content saying they don't have the same funding, they don't have the same, it's just irresponsible.
I agree. But we can't have outrage be our number one position. We have to have
it's indignation more,
yeah.
But yeah.
We have to have a methodical path to the best resolution.
To me, there's just a question. Can we say, look, we don't have a problem with the analysis or the oversight. We think the timing is off, and we think that the consultant is not qualified. So we're okay with having the analysis, but the timing of where we are is not right now, and also we don't like
first. I mean, we can certainly say that, but what the message from the city has been, you want all this money from us, we don't know if you're going to manage it appropriately. So that's why they think the timing is appropriate.
I think that's a legitimate question. And that will be obviously part of the process.
The RFP that they put out had this May deadline for the first couple pages or phases or tasks under phase one, and then I think it's an August deadline. So the city is pushing the consultant, instead of letting them do their work over, you know, a reasonable time frame, they're pushing them. So that's part of the reason I think it's poor. But Mr. Wiley started his presentation, then waited for his presentation, the end of the presentation with a pitch to do more work on a monthly basis. So I think it's going to go on for a long time, but I think, although, you know, I recognize that the city council are very good in their work life and their role as city council people, they are not investment professionals. So when Mr. Wiley has to come in front of you all who are investment professionals, we're going to understand the holes in his analysis. Hopefully, he'll put more work into it and not have the holes that he saw.
But talk about maybe you've had some better experiences in the past, but like this is a quintessential example where he does something like in front of a group of the city, right? And puts this, I agree with pretty much everything you're saying,
not a great presentation in front of them, calls you, who's on the other side of it, and is like, you know, apologetic and wants to be nice, and now you're kind of mixing and matching, and the work product is never good, and the angles that they go at things to get business is just always questionable. And so I think people just need to understand, and it, in my opinion, he's positioning for business for the future, because he can then say, I did work for Dallas Police and Fire for the city, and he's going to go spin and go to 10 more pensions and try to do this. He's at, they have a history of doing those types of things.
Yeah. Well, we have a choice. We can cooperate or not cooperate. They're going to do it. They're going to publish a report. And there's nothing you guys say that I don't think is a good observation. My view is that, you know, we cooperate. And then try to drive to a solution with the city. But I just think that if we, if that becomes its own little mini proxy war, that I think just is a huge distraction from the main goal, which is the best outcome, full, you know, the most, the clearest path to a fully funded pension, and in my view, a livable COLA for participants.
Do we lose any strength in our cause by having him come in here, us basically, you know, work with him or contest him? He comes out with a completely different conclusion, and the city says he's influenced now by the
city. You said he's influenced by what?
By us. So let's say we come in here and they basically say, well, you guys strong armed him into coming to a different conclusion after you come out with
him. It comes down to more he said, she said kind of thing. What would prevent us from putting together a position paper, working with investment staff and a historical perspective of what's transpired since the issues, and having that for the record, you know, using apples to apples and, you know, what has really happened and our fiduciary responsibility to do what's right for our constituents in that process rather than, you know.
I would say that a presentation that we gave to three of the people on the committee was essentially that work product. And that was done 2 months ago.
It was in February, March.
Yeah. So we've done that with them. And it's just a question of, do you know, because I think we're thinking about, you know, having to do something more public as the next step with that. But it is a confusing story. So, you know, you really need to think about how you communicate to a broader constituency. You know, if it's 11 things, we're not going to communicate it. It has to be like two or three things that are points that we can really logically and persuasively communicate to third parties of that, you know, and first of all, it starts where I think we all believe we do have a very competent team that has worked through incredible muck that they had nothing to do with, and has, you know, produced the best result possible, and that gives me a lot of hope going forward. So I think we do pursue a public discourse in an appropriate way going forward, but, you know, we need to get some consensus on do we cooperate or not. And then we, me, once again, that's a sidebar proxy thing to the main thing. The main thing is deliberations with the city on the best outcome possible. And if we have a position that we can't find common ground, then it kicks to the state legislature. That is the main thing.
Okay. That's why I think it's a distraction.
I agree, but what are we going to do about it?
If we don't have any control over in going forward without our cooperation, then I would say we should cooperate. If we can't control that decision, if it's already been made, then it's better for us to cooperate.
And
that's what I got. I started where you started, and that's where I got to.
So then what I envision in this whole thing is, I don't know if who was here, and you probably didn't pay attention to this, but there's this 5-year requirement that the city does this 802 audit of our actuary evaluation. So Deloitte comes in and does their analysis and they have recommendations. Part of that process is then we give a written response to their recommendation. So I would envision this to be similar. He comes with the report, he presents it to you. We can provide our written response to his points, including a, you know, the talking points or whatever are, you know, a main thing, and then each of the, you know, points that we want to make, and that is part of the report. It's an integral part of the report that he has to present together. That's how I would envision it. It is, I mean, it is distraction. I mean, we lost Kyle, Ryan, Josh, and I lost 2.5 days on this, and it was why I was making changes to the presentation this morning. It's a problem, but, you know, we are, we have to do what we have to do.
And also, this isn't Commerce Street. This is, in my view, city council people, Black men and Willis. This is, I mean, at least in my discussions, they're the ones pushing this. And, you know, I don't, I do not believe that, that Mayor Pro Tem Atkins was for this. So whether it's Commerce Street or somebody else, they're the catalyst behind this.
I think there's already a narrative out there that works for this. To be honest, like, there's this secret society that makes all these decisions that no one knows about, and it doesn't matter how much information we try to put out there, that there's still people who always, and I think it's much easier to say, after that, well, we were open, and we let, and we shared, we cooperated, and then they came out with garbage information, and we disagree with it, because they're comparing us to apples and we're making plans. And literally, I don't even know of another pension we compare ourselves to, what we've been through, but to me, it's a much easier answer. Look, we were completely open, and then they came out with a report that we disagree with, and just say, well, we thought they were incompetent, they were a bad company, they're not respected, and so we just didn't deal with them at all, even though it is.
But it's funny, we have to do the same outcome.
I agree.
Whether they say
yeah.
something good or bad,
well,
and we say they're incompetent. I mean, like.
Well, I think it's going to be a bad outcome, no matter. To be honest, I think they're going to. It's a political thing. They either want to change the governance or they just want to focus the mayor. But I think we know that. So, and I think those two specific councils, one of which is made very financially poor comments, ignorant comments at meetings, which make me question why she would ever have any issues because she just doesn't understand. But there's competent people in this room, the professionals, they know what they're doing. I could make an argument, I think, for every decision everybody in this room has made over the past 5 years. And knowing that, I think I'm just be open because I don't think the result is going to be what we want either way, but at least we can say we were open. And so don't get to leave us for secretive and you held that. It's much easier to explain how we cooperated than it is to explain why we did not in a public political setting.
So can I conclude that begrudgingly the consensus of the group is that we cooperate. We may pursue other things as well, but we at the baseline we cooperate.
As long as it's very clear that we're cooperating with someone that we don't think is partial, is not competent, and is not above reproach on the ethics.
And we can't change that. That's just
the but we will go, we will cooperate.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Good discussion.
Yes. And now for a much easier topic.
That was just the first time. No, I'm ready for it.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Okay. So a lot of these slides are repeats, just to remind you, because I know you're only here once a month. Chiron made 3 recommendations. They were city contributions based on the agency. To reduce the employee contributions as the funding level improves and the cost of living to provide some cost of living increase or cost of living adjustment earlier. As I said, kind of at the start of this, but most of this conversation today we'll talk about the COLA. We have been continuing to work with the city every morning, including this morning. I have a meeting, a call with Jack Ireland at 8 a.m. and we talk through issues. Some of the conversations are very pleasant and some of them are very stressed, either on his end or my end. But we are cooperating. We're sharing numbers and we're trying to work through things. That being said, the ball has not moved forward. So here's where we are. This slide is information from Mr. Ireland's presentation to the pension committee meeting on June 6th last week, because I wanted to make sure the words match. So where the city currently is with the city staff recommendation is they are the ABC with the five-year step-up. They have a modified COLA based on CPI not to exceed 1.5%, which is actually a takeaway. We can talk a little bit more about that in a bit. They have a future opportunity to increase the COLA based on CPI not to exceed 3% contingent on city funding. Talk about that also. Supplemental pay, 1% increase to the base pension in 2025. A supplemental pay of 1% per year of the stipend from 2026 until 70% funded, contingent on a positive return. That doesn't add into the base. And then, as you know, our recommendation from the last couple of months is ABC based on a three-year step-up. I have a modified COLA based on 70% purchasing power, a supplemental pay until we get to that 70% funded level, and then I have also some modifications of our current COLA if we're 70% funded before we get 30% erosion or purchasing power COLA kicks in. In addition to the items that are on the slide, the city has proposed significant measures to erode the control of the board and to increase the city's control over, primarily related to their, how the contributions get calculated. And we have no agreement at this point on those items, so we're still working through those. Okay, so this time, yes.
The way contributions be calculated?
Right, so what they want is they want the city to approve all of the assumptions that the actuarial evaluation is based on, which is clearly a board role, which will lower or increase the contributions the city has to make based on that calculation. And there's other things in there as well.
Can I ask you a question as far as controls go?
Sure.
The city already controls, to a certain extent, wages on that side of the benefit. Can they also control the side on retirement on benefits, retirement benefits as well, or is that a conflict of any kind?
The city doesn't have any ability right now in the statute to change, to lower the benefit. And right now, the way the statute's written, I don't believe they can increase the benefits unless we're less than 25 years of funds right now. I think the only way, and I haven't read this section in a while because it hasn't been relevant, but there might be a provision where the DPSC board and the city together could increase benefits, but clearly we're not going to do that. So they can't do that particularly, but their actions very much impact the pension fund, the funding level, the contributions that come in. I mean, the gains and losses we have are not only from investments. As they're hiring people, as they're giving big raises, that, like, they're giving a very large raise next year, that will create a loss in our pension fund. Not saying it's a bad thing, it's definitely a good thing. It will, the contribution will go up, but the actuarial loss will also go up. So it's, you know, it all works together. This is a couple of paragraphs from the PRB principle of plan design, which is a framework that they adopted, I believe, in 2018. The last bullet is really the most important one for this conversation, and just to remind you of that. It says retirement benefits should be protected against the erosion of the benefits value due to inflation. That's why the COLA is important in the plan design. So I have struggled with this concept a little bit and just thought I would talk a little bit about what is our role in the COLA conversation. Is it, should it be the city decides whether there's a COLA? I mean, forgetting the money side, which is obviously the most important piece from the city side of this, but who is it really, which entity should be the entity that drives whether there's a COLA in the plan and the format of that COLA? So I put together a few thoughts here, just something to think about. So first of all, I have, just to remind you, to meet the funding requirements mandated by the statute, a change to the COLA is absolutely not required. And the city has said that in many of their presentations, and that is true. some plans in the state and around the country don't have COLA. However, here in this city, the drastic inequity between the retirees in the same city is not logical from a pension design perspective. And right now, both plans are undergoing modifications, so this is the time that if there's going to be a change, I think it's the appropriate time to look at it. In your role as a trustee, you're neither obligated nor prohibited from urging or adopting a plan that includes the modification of COLA. You can support it, you can not support it, you can push for it, you don't need to push for it. There's nothing in your fiduciary role that prohibits you from pushing for this or requires that you push for it. You just need to, you know, do what you feel is the best. Your obligation, although you don't have an obligation related to COLA specifically, you do have an obligation to adopt the rules that meet the funding requirements, and you're obligated to consider the recommendations of independent actuary in doing so. And as you know, Tyrone only had three recommendations, and one of them had to do with doing something with the COLA. And my last bullet is, you know, I believe that the city is not considering the reality of the benefit erosion for uniform employees, well valuing highly the benefit erosion for civilian employees. So any thoughts or comments on that? I mean, this COLA piece is a difficult one in your role.
Because of the cost, it's not a morally decision, but it's because of the increasing cost.
Right.
But I think, I mean, all dollars are real and significant, but the percentage of increase given me from COLA is not a big percentage increase versus the totality of what they're funding. And you know, I looked at Chiron's work, and for me, it was an eye-opener when they highlighted the degradation of purchasing power to people that haven't had a COLA and people retiring now. And that really, to me, energized me to really think about this. And so, you know, I'm very strongly in the pro-COLA camp.
Ellen, I am at the moment. I will tell you that when you are looking at a city with its employees across the board, you can't really have things that have one for one and not the other. So and I don't think Flushden is very non-COLA that goes out. It's not nowhere near what the other side is having. This is just a bare minimum. And that's not even being considered. So whether it happens or not on a legislative basis or otherwise, I think it is our fiduciary to reevaluate and plan to consider it.
Well, status quo is there is a big disparity. So
yes.
That disparity exists actually today, and the question is, what do we do about it?
Right.
And
I personally, maybe it's just me, I guess, we keep looking at the RF, like, the RF's in trouble too. So, we're saying we need what they have, and they're broken, and I don't think their math works out, to be honest. I don't think it'll ever work out. I think we'll be, if they stick with this 3-5% or whatever without making changes, they'll be back again in 5 years because their math is screwed up. So what I keep going back to is this one basic principle that benefits should be protected against the erosion of the benefit. So that's where the COLA comes in. So I believe it is my future responsibility to protect against the erosion of the benefit. So we have to have a COLA in play. That's the most basic fundamental thing of protecting against the erosion of the benefit. So now what that looks like, I don't believe it's going to be what the RF has, because like I said, I think, you know, and I've said this before, I can't go in front of the PRB, but they don't have to do that, and make an argument, we need that because they have it, even though their pension's broken, and it's going to be broken, we need that.
Right.
But I can stand in front of them and say, we need something to protect against the erosion of the benefits. I think that's the basic, most fundamental argument.
Yeah.
Remember, this is prioritize the benefit first, which is why we prioritize ABC as
yes.
Much as
right.
We
100%.
Yeah. So just in our, we created a waterfall
yes.
Of ABC number one, COLA number two, and the third recommendation, we
love to do it, but we've made it a lesser priority, although still something we believe in conceptually, but we just realistically don't think we can get there.
And from the city's perspective, they're providing a cost for the providing a provision for a cost. It's not one that really works, but from their perspective, they thought of that or they addressed it before.
Yeah, that's 20 years. Best case scenario.
So, Michael, one thing you said that I don't agree with is the city's plan is broken. I do agree with that. But they won't be back in 5 years. And the reason for that is they are getting their cap on their ADC limit. So the city's contribution just can go up and up and up to fund their plan and their losses and their COLAs and those types of things. But the city's not considering that. They've had, I don't know how many meetings of the pension committee talking about our plan. And they had their first meeting, other than the first introductory meeting with ERS at this last one, and it was the same CAM presentation that ERS gives every time. They didn't have a 30-year cost of their ADC with or without the COLA, nothing. They didn't show any numbers, compared to ours. So, but I don't think they're just going to lift the cap without having a conversation. So this chart is Chiron's presentation. Page from Chiron's slide in February, it just says, reminds us that EPFC members are not covered by Social Security. Social Security is fully indexed to inflation over time. COLAs that don't keep up with inflation are real quick compared, you know that. Chiron included a sense, which, is here. COLAs are expensive. So the chart on the right, the graph on the right shows four lines of what happens to your purchasing power over 13 years. The bottom line is basically DPFP, a 0% simple COLA is where we are. So in 30 years, you'd have a 48% benefit. Obviously, we have a little more than that because we do have a COLA that kicks in 2046, so it'd be a little better than that. And basically, the top line would be the ERS benefit for their Tier B employees. Their Tier A employees would be better than that. This slide is actually also taken from Chiron's February 8th presentation. It just compares the two plans. Our COLA is ad hoc. Their COLA is automatic. Our COLA is tied to investment returns. Their COLAs are tied to CPI. Our COLAs can only be granted once we're 70% funded on a market value basis. They have no funding requirement, and they are not funded at 70% on a market value basis. And our first COLA with the new ADC will be granted in 2046. The bottom line is was not from Chiron's slide, that's my note. Since 2016, an ERS retiree has added 27% to their base benefit, thereby keeping up with inflation, and DPFP retiree has added 0.
Tyler, would you mind just move back one page? I just want to make sure that I'm not missing something. Why would it be the case, and maybe this is just a part of COLA that I just don't know, but if you're looking at the diminution of a dollar per inflation numbers, and that top line is 2.5% on 2.5% inflation, why wouldn't that top line be straight across 100%?
Because CPI is over.
Simple versus compounded, right?
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
Is there a compounding element to that?
Okay. Right. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Good question. All right. This slide is from Chiron. It was actually tabled on two different pages of the Chiron slide that I put together just to compare the ERS purchasing power versus the DPFC purchasing power. The darker the cells are, the worse it is. You can see just by this, I know I've said this over and over, the DPFC employee has much more erosion than an ERS employee. One of the things to note, though, on this chart. On the ERS side, there really are no Tier B employees, retirees right now. Because to be in Tier B, you were hired 2017 forward. So none of those people have retired yet. So this is really illustrative. So the Tier A people, which I don't have the data for, I would have included it, looks even better than that. So, yeah. This was a slide from the city presentation talking a little more detail about what their recommended COLA is. And I used their word for word, not to misinterpret anything. So again, what they are presenting is a two-part bridge between 2025 and 2046, which I do think is an improvement from where we were. We started the negotiation and they didn't want to do anything. So where we are now is they would like to do a 1% increase to the retiree base pension in 2025, and that gets added to the base. And then after that, they want to do a stipend if our returns are positive of 1% each year until we get to 2046. They had the second slide in their presentation as well, where they are continuing recommending compliance with HB 3158, meaning we get an ad hoc pull of 70% funded, in addition to the bridge that we talked about. The city staff supports modifying HB 3158 COLA methodology as follows. So currently in the plan, we have the five-year average return less 5%, not to exceed 4% per year, which the actuaries model that to be 1.5 because our assumed rate of return is 6.5 minus 5, 1.5. They are recommending something similar to what I recommended in my modifications. I said, let's put it at 1.5. They have said they would put it at not to exceed 1.5, which is a reduction for employees. Not the same thing as the takeaway. Future adjustments, so they have this sentence in the second to last bullet. They have this idea of this future adjustment, which is contingent on the city providing significant lump sum contributions or providing additional ongoing sources of revenue. The city may increase maximum ad hoc simple COLA based on CPI from 1.5 to 3%. So what that means is once we get to 70% funded, which is supposed to be 2046, instead of giving you up to 1.5%, they'll give you up to 3%. So that's for the last 9 years. In somebody's life, which I've modeled out, it's $20,000 over their lifetime, not a huge amount of money. But the thing that I also want to point out here, there's three words in this one bullet: contingent, may, and ad hoc. There's no way it can happen with three like legal words in there. So I wouldn't put a lot of credence in ever seeing that. And they said, which I don't disagree with, this, they're not putting it in because it's contingent into the model. Okay. So I put together a little slide here, which is different from what we normally look at. The top line is ERF, and the bottom, the orange line, is DPFP. And what you need to think about when you look at this is the bottom is not the year of the COLA that they get. The bottom is when they set their benefit or they retire. And what I've done is I've taken the city's recommended COLA and what ERF gets, and I've modeled a person from when they retire, the COLAs over their lifetime until they're 86, based on the time that they retire, average them, and this is the average COLA you'll get over your lifetime. So if you look at, say, somebody that retired in 2008, where would that be? Around here. Over their lifetime, they're going to get about where that little hand is, 1% of their COLAs over their entire lifetime will average 1%. And then somebody who retires in, say, 2035, which is kind of around here, will also get about 1%. But everybody that retires between those two are not going to get a 1% simple COLA over their lifetime. The city's argument is, and they're not wrong, that in the past we had a 4% COLA and people were getting more than inflation. That is true. But you can see because of not having COLA for a while and having low COLAs, if you retired any time after like 1995, you're still below where ERF is, and it's still a pretty small amount going forward. Does that make sense? I know this is a weird chart. Can I help in any way? I know you have to formulate the question, actually.
Blue is preferable. That would be the
So I don't understand why the second one is goes strongly down and up. I mean, like that, if you could explain.
So the reason that goes down so much is because we've had zero COLAs. So since 2017 forward. So when I take all those years of zero and average that in as part of somebody's 36 years of life, and then I take in the one pull of say in 2025 and then the stipend, and then add the 1.5, when you average all of the pulls over the lifetime, that's why it goes down so much and goes even. The ERS COLAs kind of jagged along there at the top because those are the actual COLA numbers. The, where it's above the line there, the straight line, that's losses in their actual evaluation because they've assumed, they've assumed a 2.5% for their Tier A people and 2.2% in their valuation for their Tier B people. So anytime that that COLA line is above where it comes to the straight line, those are actuarial losses. Last year, their actuarial loss was $59 million in their valuation, just from the COLA. And it, they kept losses every year. Anything else on that chart? Okay. Here's kind of another way to look at this. So what I did was I took an annual, a person that retires from ERS, Tier A or Tier B, doesn't matter which, and a DPS person. And I assume that they retired with a salary of $54,000. I took that salary because I looked at what the average salary of somebody retiring on plan last year was, and it was about $54,000. So I took the $54,000 and I applied the Tier A COLA in the first line, the Tier B COLA in the second line, and then in the third column is the DPSP COLA with the city's recommendation, the 2025 COLA, and then the stipend. And I assumed that they would get the stipend every year. In this example, it's $540. As you can see in our situation, our member would start their pension with $54,000. And then in 2025, they would have $54,540. And if they were lucky enough to receive the stipend, they would have $55,080. Every year from 2026 to 2046, that number would not go up. Whereas the city's numbers continue to go up. So by 2047, the Tier A employee has a benefit of $85,000. The Tier B would have a benefit of $81,000, which again, there aren't any of those people right now. So pretty much they'd all have the $85,000. And our employee would have $55,000. So very big difference. Over their lifetime, the difference between the Tier A employee and our DPSP employee retiring with the same pension benefit on the same day would be $780,000 less. So it's real money to this person's life. Okay, so that's just a lot of comparisons, and many people don't think it's fair for us to compare our pension with the ERS pension because there are differences. There are some benefits that we have that are better than the ERS benefit, and there are some benefits that they have that are better than ours. We paid an 8.5% contribution for a long time, and they were paying a higher contribution. They get 100% of their salary, including overtime. We don't do that. So it's really difficult, and there's criticism that we're only looking at the COLA now, and we're not looking at the past. My argument to that is we are changing the plans now. What we're looking at is going forward. So we're not looking at, you know, we're looking at the inequity between the two and pointing that out. That's all we're doing on the floor. I can't fix the past. Okay, so just a little bit to remind you where the pieces of the COLA that we've recommended, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. We talked about it last time, but if you have questions, let me know because it is confusing. So I have recommended a two-part COLA, the bridge COLA, until we're 70% funded, and that would be employees receiving a $5 per year of service before they go into drop per year that they've been in retirement since 2017. And then once we're 70% funded, the 70% purchasing power COLA would kick in, and they would either receive the 70% purchasing power COLA or the modified existing COLA, which I can talk about. So if we're in a situation where they still have not eroded 30% of their benefits, we recommended the modifications to the current COLA. Those are the pieces. The bridge COLA, to remind you, as I said, it's a 13th check, so it doesn't add in their base. Being payable every October 1st is what we've assumed here. And it's $5 per year. So it would go up every year, $5 times the number of service. So there's an example at the bottom. In 2025, the person would receive $5 times 20 years of service, and they've been retired for 8 years at 2017, so they'd have $800. And then the next year, they would get $900 because they have one more year in retirement. So that's nice versus a flat stipend because it does at least continue to increase, even though it's not in their base. The new COLA, so what the actuary has projected based on their inflation projections is it would take approximately 15 years to erode 30% of your benefits. So if you had been retired for 15 years, once we get to be 70% funded, then you would automatically start getting this 70% purchasing power. You would get a COLA that's equal to enough to bring you back up to that 70%. If, for example, though, you retired, say, 2 years before the fund received 70% funding, so you've only had a little bit of benefit erosion, you then have the modified current COLA. So you would get the COLA based on whatever we decide, CPI or whatever, but you wouldn't get the 70% purchasing power. And I wish these two 70% numbers were not the same because it makes it more confusing. Questions on that piece at all?
Do you agree with 15 years? That seems long.
They did it based on the taking in, they used the Dallas CPI numbers, and they projected based on the historical Dallas CPI numbers. And
going back like 150 years?
I don't know how they did it.
Then this seems long. You hit that threshold much faster, I feel like.
You think? You might. But what we would do is if we implemented this, is what we would have in our system is we would put in whatever we decided was the right CPI, and then on an annual basis we would compare where is this, you know, a person that retired in 2016, 2017, 2018, and that's how we would know when who got what COLA.
But you could just imagine for the last 3 years itself of the purchasing power erosion was accelerated.
Oh, for sure.
You know what I mean? So could that happen again to make the CD numbers as well?
Oh, sure. But we had many years where it was very low.
Yeah.
And if I could predict that in the future, I probably wouldn't be here. But here we are. Okay. So this is what this looks like just from a purchasing power perspective. You've seen this before. The benefit still arose, and especially if you had already been retired at the age of 15, we're not bringing a person back up to 70%. We would be taking what your benefit is in 2024 and then looking at erosion from that point. So still people would have some significant erosion down into the low 50% over their lifetime, even with the purchasing power COLA. This slide just talks about our current COLA, which you're well aware of, ad hoc, after 5 years. Projects to be 1.5%. So we have recommended modifying that where it's an automatic COLA versus an ad hoc. We would set the amount at 1.5%, so it wouldn't be the average return minus 5%. And we just did that to give some surety. And let's see. We still believe that you had to have the 70% funded. And we removed the requirement that the member needed to be 62 or 2 years retired. So those were what I have in here for the modified current COLA. All right. I'm going to have one more new slide and then a little final slide. So I put some numbers together because we've talked a lot about numbers here. And just to kind of frame how much are we talking about here and how are these two compared to the overall cost of the city. So with this, what the city is presenting with their recommended COLA over the ADC without the COLA is a 1.22% increase in total contributions over 30 years. Our recommendation is 3.7% over the city's recommendation over 30 years. I asked Chiron to do an analysis of the Tier B COLA, ERF COLA, to see what that would cost. And if the DCFP people were granted the Tier C COLA, it would cost an extra $2.2 to $2.8 billion in city contributions over a 30-year period, which equates to a 19.5% to 25% increase depending on the assumption. And what I mean depending on the assumptions is whether you use a three-year or a five-year step-up, and if you use 2.2 assumption for the COLA, which ERS actually does, or 2.5, which Chiron thinks is more reasonable. So somewhere between 19.5% and 25% would be the increase if we had the ERS COLA. The modest amount that we're asking for in the COLA that I've recommended is 3.74, so that's the comparison for you. Okay, lastly, this is just to remind you again of the recommendations. We've got 3 years. Step up the ADC, no change to the employee contributions, and the COLA. So from here, it's up to you where we go from here. Any thoughts or?
Well, just a couple comments. That as it relates to the COLA we're proposing, as we kind of drill and drill and drill, it's like, you know, doing Google Maps or kind of zoom in, zoom in. I'm sure that ultimately we might want to modify what Kelly's proposing a little bit. What we're really looking for is a commitment from the city for like that pool of dollars that then maybe we can still tweak a little bit. So we still have that out there. The other thing is as you can see, Kelly's mastery of the facts is just top, top tier. And then I've been now with her in multiple meetings with the city where she is able to not only own and know our data, but say, well, ERF 8 years ago, did that, you know, and just like in every move they're making, she's able to either provide perspective or contradict or whatever in a way that really has been amazing to see. So the fact that this sort of discussion can be had, really, I tip my hat to her on this, and I'm very appreciative that we have her in this role. So what I'd like to do is try to gain some consensus on this point that I mentioned in the beginning of, do we continue with our position of a COLA of this magnitude, or do we think more about just what I call our bare bones responsibility, tags interpreted slightly different, which I totally understand, of just adhering to the requirements of the statute. So that's what we want some directed feedback on, and then we can move forward.
I just have a question. If in the discussion, if we were to accept a five-year step-up versus a three, is there a trade in terms of flexibility on?
We approached that, yeah.
And do they see?
Well, what they've offered is, I mean, the dollar amount contribution for what they're proposing, like $1 million. I mean, in the magnitude of the whole thing, an incredibly small amount. So that's been their response.
We'd like to resolve the three pieces at once, the government, the COLA, and the ABC. The irony of the ABC is the city now in two meetings has thrown up, the DPSP wants $400 million more than what we want to do. But that their version of the ABC cost them about $100 million more than our version of ABC, so it's interesting. But we're trying to approach it as a package.
Are you looking for bare bones? Who's for continuing to push what we've been pushing so far on a legitimate COLA?
I'm for continuing to push their push legitimate COLA.
Yeah, push.
Yeah, likewise.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, I think if some of you want to try and delve into the discussion about like what I'm actually going to say, but it just seems that if there's, even if the COLA discussion, they may not be grasping fully, but it's not easy about the ones we're suggesting per se, I think. But the issue is if we ever go back to a performance base, we need money to at least try to get there for anything that would be performance based. So I think we can't even like really compromise the three step versus five step. bargaining chip, is favorable for 5 years, would be better funded COLA for the future then? Or and it's just saying, oh, you're willing, and then it puts a disadvantage and on the COLA side, then I don't think we kind of.
Well, the commitment to an ADC, whether it's traditional 3 or 5, is a huge, significant change. And I've acknowledged that in every meeting. I mean, it is. And so some of their, like, pushback and governance and all that, like, I get, you know, because it's just, it's taking something that was sort of an implicit guarantee and making it kind of explicit. And that's a big deal.
But what I don't really understand is what it, I feel like we should really go through the government side of that. What they want.
And we have done that, but I think so the governance won't really crystallize because it's all about nuance, you know, in that what they've thrown out is more topical things, and in some sense we could accept it, in other sense we couldn't. So it kind of gets to the detail and it gets to the difference between words like may and shall and all those sorts of things. And it's easier to find, I think, that if we have deal to this package and if we've sort of agreed on the ADC, agreed on a COLA, then we know those big things we can agree to, and then we can kind of sit in a room and work through the nuance of all the details. I would like, and I'm not saying this because he's voiced a different view, but Josh, on our, what sounds like the sense of moving forward and keeping it close, what's the counter argument? What would be, what's the other side of the pancake on this, about at least?
In terms of
advocating for a meaningful COLA, which right now means that we're in an impasse.
Well, I mean, is it supposed to not advocate for the COLA?
Versus a bare bones acceptance of our responsibility.
Wouldn't it just be what we had before, which is we agreed we're 70% funded and then just.
No, I'm really talking about the whole thing. What's the counter argument? If someone were here to say our statutory requirements are X, that's all you should do.
Right.
Okay, what's the argument for that versus what it seems like is the will of no, we want to push for the COLA?
Well, I mean, I think the counter argument is basically, you know, Chiron mentioned it in their presentation, that basically the statute requires you get, you know, adopt a plan that gets us a 30 years to fund. And so you're required to consider Chiron's recommendations, but one of their observations in their recommendations is that, and they acknowledge that at the end of the day, a COLA is also a, you know, it's also a policy decision on the part of the city because it's ultimately the city's obligation to make sure that there are sufficient police officers and firefighters here to make sure that we have a good and safe city. And so to do that, they determine not just, you know, they determine salary, they determine benefits, they determine things like, you know, working conditions that make people stay or leave the force. And so, you know, part of that is also sort of something like, or should we fund more money for a COLA or things like that? So that's the, I think that's the countervailing argument that is, you know, that's out there. And it's a consideration for sure that you all have heard and, you know, think about. But I think Kelly's presentation laid it out like, that doesn't mean that that's the winning argument, that's just a counter argument to the.
Yeah, that's what I was suggesting. And also, we should presume that our position will result in us going to the state legislature next year. It might not. We hope not. So we have to presume and act like it will.
I mean, I think that the issue kind of with what Josh is saying is, I mean, you've heard the city talk about money, 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 money. And I get it. I used to have that job. But, and I've heard about recruitment and retention a little bit, but I've not heard at all anybody standing up for the retirees in the city. And either employees that they've hired that have worked their entire career there that are going to retire with them that they don't understand what the actual purchasing power is going to be. And I feel like, you know, maybe it's paternalistic, but the city should care about that, and they don't. So it is the city's role to set their benefits and to put together a compensation package that works for these people, but The reality is that most of our members don't fully understand how their pension is calculated. And, you know, most people don't understand the reality of inflation in their retirement.
Yeah.
So I wish the city would look out for the retirees and we wouldn't be here, but I don't hear that when I go to the meeting.
I think the other shocking thing to me is it started to press this time around as opposed to 17 was the, and I get it, the staff for sure, that they've got the self-interest there, but the council has really, you know, and to Kelly's point, money's money, but there's only a pot of money the city has, but the city has steadfastly refused to look at the lowering, you know, creating more money by lowering the RF benefits to create more money. And I'm not saying necessarily it has to be equal. It has to be totally equal, but they could create additional funds that wouldn't have a budgetary impact, you know, by addressing. Now, in the presentation, if you looked at the ERF did, I mean, Cheryl's very smart, and they considered lowering the COLA and lowering the benefit, very small amount for the current people who have a 5%, lowering to 3%, and lowering their multiplier from 2.8 to 2.5, and increasing their contribution rate by 0.6%. So her counter-argument, which I don't think had any actuarial support, was that there's 900 people who could retire. So her argument was that the 900, you know, if you've seen the movie Network, or you'd be like Howard Beale, I'm fed up and I'm not going to take it anymore. So it's like 900 people are going to walk out the door the next day, and that will be a cost. And I turned to Kelly, and when Cheryl said that, I said, you know, if you said that to our board, you know, you'd be skewered. It's like, what's the basis for that statement? And there's no way an actuary supported her statement in that. She just, that was her sort of defense against lowering their benefits to create a savings. And it's just, and the council is fully supported not touching ERF. And it's unfortunate. And that's really, as much as anything, a way to create the funds as, you know, money's money type of thing, to create the funds necessary to fund a meaningful, you know, COLA here for the retirees as well as the act. So it's surprising the lack of traction that's gotten, considering all the kinds of people say they love police and fire, but I'm, you know, at this point in these processes, it surprises me anymore. So,
is it a conflict of interest, kind of? I mean, pretty obvious.
I mean, that's yes, but it's also inherent. You know, you always have to have city people working, you know, work there. They're in the pension, but usually you have a council that's calling them on it. I think a couple of council people might be in the plan from their prior job, but but when you've got, you know, the city manager on down is all in the plan, it's tough to get.
That's what I mean.
So if you sit here today, my sense is that you're saying that you continue to fight for a meaningful COLA. We could actually approve a plan today. I think our guidance is that's probably, you know, early. That we continue our discussions with the city. I think we've all been advised on the bare bones requirements versus what sort of our goals and desired outcomes are, that, you know, it may take on, you know, us becoming more public going forward, that's, you know, a likely part of this. And, but what I'm hearing is no one is supporting the bare bones outcome period, that the will of the group is to support advocating for meaningful COLA, and am I correct in assuming that you concur that not approving something today and continuing dialogue makes sense for at least another month or so?
Well, we should have a full course of vote, don't you think?
Well, I'm just trying to gain a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that a fair?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement.
Very fair.
Okay. We'll do our best in terms of if we do things public, of keeping, you know, everyone informed. I mean, it gets a little dynamic at times, and you know, anyone wants to play a more outside role in And Josh, we're here, but, you know.
I'm just a little bit heartened by the seasons out that are being thrown out there by through our membership for our staff currently. It really is a real thing. There's a real, like, germinating agenda, and I feel it would be very dangerous if it was only first by this situation.
Well, when you give us suggestions on what we can do, there's only so much time. I mean, these are all kind of outsized, non-recurring tasks. I remember that Kelly and team have the recurring task of running the pension. We don't have a separate, you know, hit squad team that can come in and do, you know, like a McKinsey group or something like that. This is the team. So we need to be mindful of that.
I think just any way you can kind of like make and slice what, like that erosion, like that showing that in the way that it was Europe and that thing, what a person retired at 55, that is, I think, very powerful. Those type of things really speak. They're data. It's just data and numbers. We're not, you know, as much as you can do like that. Nobody's actually tough.
I know,
but like the data
that they. Yeah, I think the one of two people retiring today and the 700,000 discrepancy, you know, 25%, that's strong. The chart of the degradation is strong.
Yeah.
They say it's apples and oranges. I mean, everything's always at some nuance, yeah, elected or level, apples and oranges, but at its base level, there's just an unfairness issue of two people that work for the city, one in public safety, one not. Another person that didn't had a worthy career, not disparaging that at all, but there shouldn't be this sort of discrepancy. And the fact that our pension is troubled is their fault. It is decades of poor actions on the part of mayor and city council and who they pick. And you know, when you look at 10-year returns, well, a big portion of that 10-year is on them. That's a tough story to communicate, but that's the reality of it. It's like saying, you know, looking at your 10-year crime statistics. I mean, maybe they aren't great, but in the last 2 or 3 years, they've been pretty good, and that's what matters to people today. But if someone wants to show 10-year statistics, you can't argue that they're not factually true. They just don't tell the story in the most forthright way.
But in a simple way, I think that some of these council members have to somehow explain to the constituents why this big budget line. And it's easy for them to say it's not us, despite the fact that 7 years I was clearly here when you and Bill were before them and said, this is, yes, we're seeing that, but this over here is not being attended to. And it was very, despite their disagreement, vocalized that nothing was being done to this problem. So today, it's come to roost, and now they say, it's not us, but and they're pointing the fingers, so to speak. It's disingenuous, but to your point, it is, they need to within for accountability on that part, too.
Yeah.
And they're being politically driven, they've got no motivation to do it. Unless you want to withhold some of their pay to learn, they're never going to change it, and the system's never going to change it. It's just
so it's easy to get someone else to say, not the vehicle, the drivers.
Someone used a great, I watched that clip twice, that the full meeting, and I forget who it was that said it, but I thought it was a great analogy. And it was basically like you're comparing two runners, and you're looking at their times, and one's crippled, one's not, and you're saying, well, wow, that person must be a much, much better runner. Well, you don't know that information. You can't compare those two runners. It's not apples to apples.
He actually made one more dangerous thing that I thought was, I also saw on my show when he said that. He said, oh no, this fund should be able to, can perform just at the top line. He said it's clear out. Yeah, it should have, it can have a similar performance. And I was like,
who's clever yet? Well, we are performing well now, and we have good governance, and we have a high degree of confidence that the reality of it is that we're a highly competent, highly performing group, and we can steward the additional money well.
we didn't believe that would make it a lot tougher. I truly, truly believe that. So
I think people are going to start seeing that. I mean, as time passes and we start to shed past decisions and assets, we're going to get better allocated. We're going to be more in line. And we're going to start putting up points. And people will see that. It's just going to take a little bit of time. But we're at an advantage like some other places are. We're just kind of different paths.
Well, yeah. We are much better allocated than we were in 17. We have made great progress. It's just hard to see.
Yeah. Okay. We're good to move on. Okay. Brenda, financial officer, status.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. The initial field work for our audit is underway. We've completed about 70% of the PVC list auditor requests and have submitted them to the audit team. We've sent all of the confirmations with the exception of the legal and the actuarial, which we'll do towards the end of the audit. We've sent the member census data on to BEO so that they can start looking at that information before we receive the actuarial report. We have received some information from the HUD fund and so we're working on that valuation, and we've been promised to receive the remaining part of that information by the end of the month. So we're hopeful that that will be the case in months and months ahead of where we were last year. Once we receive that final investment information, we can submit our information to the actuaries, and from that point, it will be about 60 days. We should have audited financials. In the meantime, we're continuing to work on all the parts of the audit, all the parts of the annual report, the charts and the graphs that you see there, working on those as much as we can, and we look forward to bringing those and showing that information to you in the future when we get it finished.
And Melissa has already finished resigning next, so then I need to like it. I was going to add, if anybody has a new headshot or anything and they want that to be updated in their after or annual report, to email it to me.
There may be a few headshots that are dated like a good bottle of wine that might need to be updated. Yeah.
When's the deadline? If you could get it to me maybe within the next month.
We submit a younger picture of a younger person that kind of looks like us.
Yeah, I would get it.
Hey, I got an idea.
Who's the staff photographer?
There you go.
Snap for everybody. Okay, Kelly, ministerial action, contribution report, and trustee education.
Okay, there's really nothing unusual on any of these in this month. There are 10 retirements, 21 refunds. Those are right on track, so nothing out of the ordinary there. As far as the contribution report goes, now we have the second month in a row that we are over the hiring plan estimate. It was a little higher last month, but we are still 3 people over the hiring plan estimate, so that's good. During this month, we had, this was April data, 2 pay periods. We received $13 million from the city, and the employee contributions were $5.1 million, which is nothing unusual at all there. And on the next item, the trustee education, if anybody wants to attend any of these classes, let us know. I have been to the NC First Public Pension Forum, and in my opinion, that's the best class because it's all actuarial and that's the stuff I love. You might not love it as much as I did, but if you're thinking about attending one, I think that one's good. It's in Boston and Austin. So let us know if you want to attend.
What date?
August 18th to the 20th. And then Tech First is summer, which is also a good conference in San Antonio. Okay. And that, I will hand it over to Ryan.
Great. Thank you. All right. To start off, since we were talking about it earlier, even Nick mentioned we can't have you let stories we're trying to tell. So I was thinking about kind of what it should be, and I think it's the quality of the government, the quality of the board, and the IT, you guys know that. the future policy we have in place now. Tremendous progress we made on the legacy portfolio. We've gone from two-thirds of the portfolio in 16 down to just below 25% now. With those proceeds, we've covered 100% of benefit outflows, rebuilt the public portfolio completely. 9 out of the 11 public managers are new since 2016. So we've been able to rebuild that part of the portfolio, but also focus on ensuring we have enough in cash and short-term bonds to cover 18 months or more of benefit outflows. And then I think number 4 of that will be coming with hiring Baltimore and rebuilding a new private asset portfolio that is structured appropriately and should perform well. So hopefully those things come across and what we go through with the portfolio update, being a little bit behind and the key to on the phone to cover performance. We'll move through this relatively quickly, but stop me if you have any questions. So overall portfolio is up 4% year to date, the public portion is up 6.2%. On liquidation of private market assets, it's been a bit slow year to date with about $10 million coming back. But we have a few sales, fingers crossed, lined up in the private asset, private equity portfolio that could be pretty considerable on proceeds coming back to us. Rebalancing, we refilled the safety reserve in April by only $28 million out of the global equity market, get us back up to the 9% target. And then on the custodian search, we had interviews with finalist firms earlier this week. We expect to bring a recommendation back to the board to rely on that front. Looking at initiatives going forward, we plan to IAC meeting to move to August 15th. We're going to bring additional asset allocation mixes back to the IAC. Custodian search already mentioned. I think in September, October, we'll probably hopefully bring a final asset allocation recommendation back to the board. From that, we'll need to update the investment policy statement. And then we are planning on officially engaging all board on July 1st so we can start this planning. And we have quite a few IPS provisions and governance things to work through on how that new investment in that portfolio will work. On asset allocation, kind of just went through it, but we had a meeting in March and we want to take a harder look at some of the EM education and then look at the public credit portfolio and it lines up well because McHugh's going to cover that for that sort of portfolio as they go through their performance here in a minute. Equity market returns, this is both the beginning of 2022. Obviously got quite a bit over the last year. But I think we were benchmarked to a global equity index with ACWI, and that over the last 2.5 years is just above water, up 1.6% annualized. So I keep hearing about how well the market's doing, it's doing very well, but I think we're realizing the last 2.5 years, U.S. is doing a bit better, but it's just now above water again. I didn't need a yellow market chart, I left it on there. Exclamation point. But this is looking at kind of addressing some of the points on the U.S. outperforming, why we invested there, why we have a global benchmark, invest globally in the stock market. This is looking at EM markets with the pink line, U.S. equity with the blue line, and then international with the green line, and the global kind of in between. But basically, the U.S. versus international EM kind of gone in big cycles ranging from 6 to 12 years of underperformance, outperformance. We're kind of at 10 years now. The U.S. are outperforming both EM and international, and there's good reasons that's occurred. But we kind of longer term, we don't expect that to continue forever. So that's one of the reasons we've chosen to take a global approach to the equity portfolio. On the public performance, up 7.4% over a 5-year period, that's outperforming the 60-40 by a considerable margin. Equity portfolio is a little bit closer to benchmark returns overall based on the most recent endpoint, but if we go forward to fixed income, it's performing quite well versus, you see a lot of green on this page. compared to benchmark. So I'll let McKee go into more detail on that. Ended the month with $1.975 billion in AUM. I mentioned earlier we're 4% year to date. Safety reserve, we're good with the rebalancing that just occurred. If we get money back kind of mid-summer with some of these planned sales, if they occur, we'll probably look at, you can see down here on that kind of heat map, we're still a bit under-allocated to our fixed income managers, so that's probably the next area that we try to top back off, and then look at adding to the Northern Trust Equity Index Fund from there. With that, any questions on the portfolio?
How has your funding search gone?
Been, so we, I'll just say we're very happy we hired Calvin to help us out with it. It's a very complex RFP in areas that we're not focused on every day like they are in terms of what we should be asking the custodian banks and service levels. So, We were happy with the interviews we had this week, and I think we'll have a good outcome. So we'll have, I guess, we can go into more detail on it next month on selection. All right, Leo, Aaron, you guys on the line?
Yeah, I'm here, Ryan. It's Aaron.
Yes, I'm here.
Clicking for you, so.
All right, thanks. Well, good morning, everybody. We've got three items today, nothing that requires a motion or a vote. We're going to start with one of our asset class deep dives. So we're looking at your public credit strategies, and then we'll cover the first quarter of 2024 performance. And very, very briefly, the final item is the private market report looking at the fourth quarter 2023 private market NAVs. So Ryan, just go to the first page of this. Okay, there you go. So DPSP is invested with three different public fixed income strategies that fall into the credit bucket. And in total, you've got about $200 million in exposure, that's currently a little below your target. And those three managers combined are producing a very healthy yield for DPFP, so a yield to maturity of 8.5%. Ryan, go to the next page, please. Here we look at it under the hood a bit more. So the three managers are Aristotle, they're your bank loan strategy, Loomis Sales, your high yield manager, and MetLife, your emerging market debt manager. If you look at the couple of columns there, you know, all three are contributing to that strong yield with generally pretty low duration. So bank loans practically have no duration given the floating rate component. High yield, low duration of 3.4, EMD, 5.5 years. And you can look at all these in comparison. We chose the broad high yield bond market index. So you have a yield advantage with lower duration. So now we drill into each of the three managers. We start with Loomis. So your history with Loomis goes back 25 years. We implemented a strategy change about 4 years ago, moving from the really full discretion, wide variance strategy to a more benchmark aware strategy that still has some pretty good degrees of freedom. So you can see up top, those red numbers signify underperformance versus the benchmark. So Loomis has struggled. They've been some of their off-benchmark names haven't worked, and they've been a little too conservatively positioned in the last couple of years where lower quality names have outperformed. So we are evaluating all options with Loomis. Us and staff are working on possible fee concession with this product. And as part of the asset allocation decision, staff and us are looking at kind of possible ways to revisit credit in general, which could dictate some changes to this mandate. So we don't want to put the cart in front of the horse here and make any quick changes now on this product until we decide what to do with the credit bucket in general, which may involve bringing in a multi-sector strategy, and then we'll decide what to do with Loomis. But for now, you know, it's a strong team that is going through a rough patch, and we'll evaluate and continue to monitor.
And just on the asset allocation, what we're talking about there, right now we have a very siloed approach, 3-4% allocation each to EM debt, high yield, bank loans. We're looking at combining it into potentially 1-12% allocation to public credit, which gives us a bit more freedom to bring in multi-asset, tweak the allocations between these 3 or 4 buckets through a structure review of the board.
When you guys just do kind of like routine screening for on the fixed income side, whether it's core or high yield, like a minimum AUM cutoff is like part of the screening criteria?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like we don't want to be more than 10% of a strategy. So, I mean, depends on that class, probably 600, probably 800 million and up.
Okay.
All right, I'm on the Aristotle page.
So, Eric.
Sorry, Aaron.
Your question?
I don't even know how to. Why would we go, and I know this probably more in the deeper discussion, but is it really practical or appropriate to give that much to one credit guy the ability to move throughout fluidly? I mean, like, isn't it better to have some specialized needs? Especially in the credit bucket, I mean, you know what I mean? Or is it, are there managers that have liquid vehicles that can fluidly go outside of just investment grade and treasury and things like that?
Yeah, Aaron, did you hear the question?
Why would you go with the broad multi-sector?
Yes, exactly, versus the specialized.
Yeah, there's...
Go ahead, Aaron. I'll let you tackle first.
You started being in the room.
Okay, so like Loomis, they have a full discretion team, and the high yield team sits amongst the full discretion team. So it's the same group of PMs talk every day, and it allows them, kind of like we do with their equity managers, to pick U.S., you know, what geographies is a little bit different in fixed income, but it allows them more flexibility to see what areas from a duration standpoint, from a credit, you know, standpoint, they find most attractive and make those allocation decisions for you as opposed to what we have now where we're kind of stuck a third between those three asset classes.
But my point is that you know, those numbers don't look good.
Well, I mean, I think
my point is there like, does getting skewed somehow, but well, that I'm just going to say.
Yeah, it wouldn't be like we're not going to combine it and giving 12% to one manager. That might be a portion of what's in the public credit portfolio. And I mean, generally, I think our view is even with private credit, all of this stuff is going to merge where you have semi-liquid credit and what bank loans managers are doing are going to be pretty similar to what direct lending managers are doing at some point in the future. So, I don't know, Aaron, anything you want to add there?
That's not problematic to me, though.
I mean,
you know what I mean? Bank loans and direct lending and, you know, so that's even a bigger, like, gamut, in my opinion. So, that is just one thing that it uses exactly like a multi asset within that credit, and that performs that way.
Yeah, I mean, they have other things in their multi asset portfolio, but I'm sure that their high yield asset, you know, credit selection is dragged down with that product as well. I think a trend that we're seeing across a lot of other peer plans to kind of add more
money.
Just in terms of Makita's other clients, I mean, have they seen higher high-yield managers that have done much better than they did here, just from comparison?
Yes. We don't want to get in the habit of just terminating someone every time they're doing bad. We believe in the team, but they struggle. So it definitely considers, you know, evaluation when we get to that allocation first and decide what
we're doing. We've always done that. We're not talking about like in the last 3 years. We do like that 3 to 5, 10. I mean,
yeah.
We consider the longer, and we do consider what the management change ever has been. So, I mean, for those given parameters, I mean, I'm glad that we're bringing it up.
Yeah. So, I think if you to ask me what the biggest area of concern on the public side of the world is, and big priorities is address them and what to do there once we get to asset allocation.
How crucial is Dan, to the overall process?
Big question. Aaron, do you have any perspective there on he was very crucial to our prior product. He was aging. And I don't know how involved he is at all now in kind of portfolio management. But the product we were before was the Dan Goss product, and we're more onto the high yield, a little more constrained product now.
Yeah, I think I caught most of it. Basically, it was the question, is Dan Fuss still involved at Loomis? And I haven't heard his name much. He seemed to be mostly talked about in past tense. I think he's probably almost, I don't know, guess, but maybe 90 years old. So I don't think he's that involved anymore.
Okay, but he was probably responsible for a good part of the performance. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, the legacy strategy, yeah, he definitely was a star PM for a significant portion of the early 2000s.
Yeah, okay, none 2010. Of them being on this page, but the prior product, the 98 and forward product for sure.
Okay. Key consideration then. Yeah, you know, maybe it's time to revisit.
Definitely. Okay, I'm going to go ahead to Bank Loan Center.
All right.
Aristotle.
Yeah. Yeah. So, easier conversation with Aristotle and then MetLife. Aristotle has been, DPFP has been invested with Aristotle since 2017. It used to be Pacific Asset Management. Aristotle purchased this team a few years ago, and the marriage has worked out well culturally and ownership wise. The strategy has performed well. It generally they seek to buy, to you know, invest in bank loans that are part of the most liquid part of the market issued by the larger companies, and they've executed well. So we have no concerns, and this is a high conviction strategy we've used with a lot of other clients.
And the last row of numbers are at the top. That's pure rankings for their top decile over the 3-5 years in their peer group.
So the final one, and back to Aristotle, that was a great investment for DPFP during the whole last 3 years as rates rose and your duration was very minimal there. So finally, MetLife Emerging Market Debt. This is a blended strategy. They'll invest in both USD-denominated bonds issued by foreign governments as well as local currency bonds and corporate bonds. The strategy is off to a great start, both in relative and absolute figures. They've benefited from a bit more U.S. dollar exposure and less local currency exposure than the blended benchmark. They've also have a significant, a nice yield advantage versus the benchmark, as they've been a little lower in quality and they've been rewarded for that. So no concerns here. Happy with how they've been doing during the short period of time DPFP has been invested.
I mean, they're great.
So just. Okay. So that'll conclude this section. That's just a continuation of kind of fulfilling of the investment policy statement guidelines in terms of periodically looking at different asset class structure and how the managers are performing. Yeah, this is a good one here, Ryan. So this is the...
One quick question before we move on. In the emerging market debt area, are there any legacy assets that these folks have that are tied to Russia or Argentina or some of the more problematic countries?
Christina, do you know if they have any exposure there? This product, and I don't believe so, this product is much more, I know they think more of overweight to like LATAM countries. I don't know if they have any Argentina exposure, but.
Yeah, I don't know exactly for sure, but I think they do rotate in and out certain countries. I don't believe they have exposure to Russia. After the conflict in the Middle East broke out, they rotated out of, you know, exposure in Israel and Saudi and stuff like that. But I think this manager has their mission has performed really well. I think they've been pretty nimble, and they because their universe, you know, they invest in sovereign corporate and local currency, and they've been pretty nimble rotating in and out of exposures.
Okay. We were still invested with the actual portfolio when the Russian-Ukraine stuff came out. So we had about a few million in Ukrainian exposure that got written off in that portfolio before we made the change.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, all of these are on our behalf, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they have high upside and downside capture, but it's been an up market, and they got performed. I mean, it was 15.1 versus 11.5. Them. All right, Aaron, back to you.
All right. So this page you're seeing on the screen is a one-year summary ending March 31st of this year. So you see a mix of green and red, but mostly green. Strong performance in absolute terms. And as a consultant, my eyes always just go to right where the negative things are. So the only places that are negative, you underperformed your policy benchmark by, you know, a healthy spread. And that is a result of an underweight to global equity during these 12 months, which was the cause of or the result of being overweight to real estate, frankly, overweight to private equity as well. But everything else, generally pretty strong period. Managers doing well. Public markets doing well. And that safety reserve below threshold is now back up to target. Brian, if you move to page 87, please.
There you go.
So I know there was a lot of talk at the start of the meeting about how well, you know, criticizing the past and the decisions that have been made. So this is a great simple scorecard to see, you know, the selection success from the board and the IEC. And to state the obvious, you know, the columns, the three-year and the five-year are frankly more meaningful given they include the last 1 year as well. But if you look at the three and the five, one thing I first see is this a significant number of NAs indicating there's been a lot of change, and the board and IEC have been very active. But once you look beyond that, there's a lot more green than red. So the managers that are being hired are outperforming, by and large, versus the benchmarks that we judge them. To go to the following page, this is where we look at the regional exposure by the everything together, and there was, I know, the bit of Monday morning quarterbacking about the U.S. weight versus non-U.S. looking backwards. Well, here we show which global managers are invested and how well, you know, what their regional biases are. So if you look to the color bars at the bottom, the blue light bar on the left is the total DPFP public equity. The green, the light green, is the ACWI IMI. So the broad index has about 62% in U.S. And if you look to the pink, yellow, purple, and the brown, those are your global managers. So they, by and large, do have an underweight to U.S. And this is consistent with what we've seen in the real full universe of global equity managers. And a lot of that is they are, in their minds, positioning for the future. The U.S. is pretty expensive. Non-U.S. is less expensive. And so they're trying to position for the future. All said and done, if you look at the total program in the gray rows, DPFP does have about a 10% underweight to U.S., which is offset naturally by overweights to Europe, Japan, et cetera, in the developed markets, and a very, very small, slight overweight to EM. Any questions there? Okay. So we'll close this section with the following. Let's go to page 93, Ryan. All right. This is a chart that we've skipped over probably every single meeting. It's a classic risk return scatter plot showing DPFP versus other public pensions over $1 billion. You got return on the vertical axis, volatility or standard deviation on the horizontal. And then you can see the kind of the meat of the distribution is highlighted in the blue. And then the real center of everything is where the black lines cross. For the first time in my memory, DPFP is really squarely right there in the meat of the distribution of other public pensions. And this is a 3-year period. For so long, your returns have just been a true outlier because of the legacy assets, because of the anchor effect of that. And so you're finally, and it takes time to start seeing this in the trailing numbers, but you're finally starting to act and perform like a healthier plan because many of those assets have been liquidated over the time period. So this chart used to always provide kind of meaningless comparison, but it's very encouraging to see that now DPFP is performing like other pension plans.
Quick question. Is this apples and apples in terms of a comparison for our fund versus other funds of similar size?
In this universe, yes, $1 to $5 billion. We're not adjusted for cash flow situation.
Funding
rate or anything like that, but okay, yeah, similar size public DB plan.
Good.
We get T-shirts made, give it to the
city
council
people.
Yeah, we'll get the real
about valuation. After you explain, that's what it's a multi, perfect.
Right. Current.
Yeah. All right, Aaron, do you want to move forward to other slides here or to the private market?
Okay, we'll move to private markets, please. So page 114. This will be brief. Kind of a quiet period, fourth quarter NAVs. You see, a slightly negative return. The big event or the big distribution that occurred, and this is now looking back 5 months, but you got the liquidation of the JPM Maritime Fund, so you got that distribution of about $16 million. But all said and done, it was a pretty uneventful period of time these 3 months. If you look to the NAV in the gray bar, gray row, 1231, about $500 million in private markets left. So there was a time, not too recently, where that was over $1 billion, and you had half of your portfolio in private markets. So the liquidation has been happening, just slow and steady. The following two or three pages basically shows the same breakdown, but by asset class. So you can see real simple snapshot of which asset classes were distributing and which asset classes were having meaningful changes in NAV or fairly flat NAV.
Well, one of the points with the city is that if we had written off or supplier sale everything back, say, in 2017, and just used 20 cents on the dollar, we'd have much better track record of investment results because it wouldn't have the overhang, and it would, you know, make us a little better. But what it would do, it would take the new ADC, it would have to be substantially higher.
Right.
Yep.
You'd have a much, much bigger hole. So I've tried to communicate to them that we've undertaken a salvage operation, meaning that you don't, we're not, it's not the intended, original intended use. We're going to compound at a good rate of return, but we can extract cash out of these things at certain points in time. So walking away from it was not the right thing to do. Extracting what we can was the right thing to do, but one of the effects of it is that it shows, it detracts from performance. The performance is the performance, so you can't say that's not real performance, but it's just a different, it's just a completely different fundamental thing, a salvage operation versus your ongoing portfolio.
But I will say something even more. That has been the source of our contribution to benefit.
Correct.
Without having to degrade our allocation to actual investment. So it was that process of trying to pull value out of those and give them towards benefit. That has been what's been helping us the last 7 years.
Correct. But the effect of that on returns has been used against us.
Right. But had we written down everything up front, we would have had to then start pulling from allocations.
No, I agree. We made the right decision. I'm just saying that one of the second derivative from the right decision is it creates a more negative track record because of the overhang. But I would do it again without even hesitation. It was the right thing to do.
No, yeah, I mean, if we would have sold everything at 50 cents on the dollar in 2016, our NAV would be $1.2 billion and the ADC would be $700 million, or the shortfall would be $725 million higher, so the ADC would be $45 million higher per year, basically.
And it probably wouldn't have been worse, because once other funds smell blood in the street, they're going to take advantage of it.
And well, yeah.
You would have gotten much lower prices than
that. Yeah. That's all for assuming that you could sell everything for just $1, and a lot of the stuff we had was not sellable.
Yeah, but I mean, you still have 25% of your portfolio that if you could sell it all at NAV today, would you? Yeah, I mean, I think for sure we would. But that, you know, degrades from the return position. So, good. Go ahead. Let's go ahead and find it out. Anything else?
Anything else you want to add, Aaron?
No, just agree with Nick's points there. You know, if you fire sale everything, generating returns on a lower base because you have a lower denominator may look good, but at the end of the day, you'd have less capital, and that's really what matters.
Sure. Well, Aaron, we appreciate what you guys are doing. I will point out that they were very helpful in some of the discussions last week with Commerce Street. So, you know, in addition to kind of the normal course, having them, we can call them on the bat phone and say, hey, we need some help, like today. They were really, really helpful.
Yeah, Leo happened to be in Dallas, but he changed his life and stayed with us in the conference all day.
And Colin dropped everything.
Yeah, Colin, yeah.
So, guys, we really appreciate that. Good space.
Thank you very much.
All right, anything else, Ryan, Makita?
Nope, not me.
All right, thanks so much. Now, those Lone Star Investment Advisors, we always look forward to what's going on there as the world turns. Ryan, Josh?
Closed session?
Yeah.
All in closed session? Okay. So, ready to go into closed session?